Welcome to another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, associate professor and extension urban horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, thanks for joining us again. I'm Linda Chalker-Scott, and that long-winded title just means that I take information from articles about plant science and translate it for you to use in your garden. Every week, I'm going to stretch your mind a little bit by showing you how you can use this plant science in your garden to save time, money, and natural resources. The information I share is always based on scientific research that either I or one of my colleagues in the university system has conducted. And each week, I'm going to try to follow some kind of theme. Today's theme is going native. I'll tell you why buffalo grass might be as good for your lawn as it used to be for buffalo, how some non-native plants might be the key to building a bird-friendly garden, and why native plants might not be the best choice for your home landscape. We'll also head outside to chat with Seattle gardener and goat keeper Laisha Bailey about how she manages a dairy goat herd in the middle of a city. But first, let's look at native plants in the news. My first article is from sciencedaily.com. It's all about some research on how to use native grasses instead of those traditional turf grasses when you're planting your lawn. First, a few fun facts, or maybe not so fun facts. Did you know that there's 40 million acres of lawn in the United States? That's more than is used for any agricultural crop in the entire country. It's an amazing amount of acreage. And it costs a bunch of money to maintain all that lawn too. It's estimated that we use 800 million gallons of gasoline, $5.2 billion in fertilizers, and $700 million in pesticides. And those fertilizers and pesticides, they take fossil fuels to make them. It's a lot of money, a lot of resources to keep one monoculture alive. And what a monoculture is just same species planted all over. And that's what many of our lawns are. Even worse, especially given that drinking water is becoming harder and harder to get in some of our communities, as much as two-thirds of the local drinking water can go to watering lawns, which is just unsustainable when you think about global warming and drinking water becoming harder and harder to get. We really need to change the way that we think about our lawns. Unfortunately, there's some great researchers down at the University of Texas who've been working at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Austin, and they've been comparing our typical lawn to some native grasses that might be better choices for our lawns. So they looked at Bermuda grass, which is a typical hot climate lawn grass. Many people are going to be familiar with this who live in the southern part of the country. And they compared that to several native grass species. They took care of everything the very same way. Same amount of water, same amount of mowing, same amount of fertilizer. And then they compared some characteristics that would be important to a homeowner. What they found was is that the native grasses were more lush than the Bermuda grass. What that means is that in the spring, the grass was 30% thicker when they used the native grasses and 20% thicker in the summer. If you think about that, if you want a lush lawn, the way you normally get it is with lots of water and fertilizer. So if you have a native species that can do that on its own, you're using less water and less fertilizer to get that very same impact. They also found that if you use more than one species of grass in your lawn, that they are better able to resist weeds. What they did was they deliberately, if you can imagine, scattered dandelion seeds all over these turf grass experiment plots. And they found that the ones planted with Bermuda grass or just one species of native grass had more dandelions. But when they mixed up several grass species and grew them together, there were fewer dandelions that were able to get through and grow in that mixed species lawn. So there's some really great research going on out there that is showing us how we could have a more sustainable lawn using our own native plants, rather just relying on that one species of grass that may or may not be the best choice. The next article I found came from my favorite source, I say, unbiasedly, of course, which is the Garden Professor's blog. It's the blog that I contribute to as well as some other professors, and that's at gardenprofessors.com. Last November, I did a posting about how to plant for fruit-eating birds. And if you're not familiar with this word, frugivore, it's a new one. Now, you might think by listening to it that frugivore might mean the same thing or come from the same word as frugal, but birds aren't cheap, even though they do cheap. What frugivore really means is fruit eating. So a frugivorous bird is one that eats fruit either as part of its diet or maybe all of its diet. And as it turns out, birds that like to eat fruit prefer those that are red or black. So you can think of huckleberries and blackberries and blueberries. Those are really the birds' favorite types of fruits. They also like really pulpy fruits, nice, big, thick juicy fruits. And in our part of the country, invasive blackberries are one of their very favorite fruits. And so it's a real conundrum. What do you do when you've got bird population that has come to depend on invasive plants? Do you take all the invasive plants out and starve your birds, or do you let the invasive stay? It's a very difficult question, and a lot of communities are trying to deal with that. But anyway, in terms of your own garden, you should consider that you might be able to find some plants that are natives or maybe not natives to add some additional food for your birds and attract them to your garden. So what I recommend if you're trying to figure out some bird-friendly trees or shrubs or vines or ground covers is, first of all, always use native species if they will live in your site conditions. Some people have conditions in an urban area that aren't really very natural. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But for the most part, try to choose native species. At the same time, you want a really diverse landscape. That means none of that monocultural grass that we just talked about. If you have a lawn, that's great, but you're going to want some shrubs. You want some small trees, maybe some vines. You want there to be lots of places for shelter and nesting to attract your birds, as well as for food. And then when you go to the nursery, you'll be happy to find that there are a lot of commonly available non-native shrubs and trees that are not invasive, that also have brightly colored fruits. And the reason that they're so common is because we like them ornamentally to have those types of fruits in our gardens. So you might find some that have black fruits, red fruits, not things you would normally eat, but that birds might find delicious. And do be aware that birds really see best in the red end of the color spectrum. Anytime you're planting for birds, you want to be planting towards the red end, the orange end, and so the fruits and flowers will be sure to attract them. And then finally, if you do choose some non-native species, check the web first to make sure they're not invasive. There's a great plant database at plants.usda.gov and has great information on invasive species for every state in the country. Heard of goats? Well, of course you have, but herding goats in the city is a little bit different than it is up in the Swiss Alps with Heidi. We recently visited Laisha Bailey, a Seattle resident who raises dairy goats in her urban garden. We started out by asking if goats really do eat everything that normally goes into yard waste.
The only thing that goes in yard waste are some thorny branches after they have finished eating them. That is really the only thing that goes in my yard waste, and I am starting to biochar more of that, and that will be used in the bedding in the pen, and I would like to just get rid of yard waste totally. I don't need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Instead of spending carbon picking up the yard waste with these big trucks, hauling it to a big processing facility outside the city, using more carbon to and big industrial infrastructure to do all of that, and then getting in plastic packaging and then people driving to buy it more. I would like to shorten that whole process from goat to garden. That's about 50 feet.
That sounds like the title of a book, From Goat to Garden.
There we go.
I think that's what you ought to do.
There we go. Do you see that giant brush pile back there? So that giant brush pile is all browse, which are green branches, things they can eat that have been brought here. They prefer the leaves and the young twigs, the older branches like that. I then run through a wood chipper and it becomes bedding for their pen. So again, yard waste is not necessary.
And you probably collect a lot of this from other places other than your own yard?
I do. I collect a lot of it from neighbors, from friends who are gardeners, from roadside and unused areas that we spend tax dollars clearing. And so as members of the community, the goats are becoming very popular to help with that way. Since they are valuable dairy goats, I would never leave them there unsupervised. Mm-hmm. Things like unleashed dogs can be a major danger to them. But it's easy to stop and takes about 10-15 minutes to load up a car or a truck full. On my way home, I rarely go out of the way to gather things.
Well, you know, I've seen a couple times when I've been driving around herds of goats on hillsides eating away at ivy and blackberry and everything else. Do you use your goats that way, or are yours strictly dairy goats and not out for rent?
Mine are valuable dairy goats, and I do want quite a bit of say in what they're eating and balancing their nutrition. On the other hand, some of the dairy goat purists only feed hay and alfalfa pellets. And I think that's kind of like living on Triscuits and power bars. That's not quite a whole diet in my book. And so in the winter, I try to make sure they get at least 5 different species of fresh food every day. And in the summer, at least 20. And it's very easy. There are no weeds virtually in my life.
I'll bet.
And as far as renting them out goes, in the dairy world, there are excess boys. And neutered male boys do make very good packing companions for hiking, as well as brush-eating pets.
So they could kind of clear the trail as you go.
Sure, sure. When we've been volunteering at a local community garden this year, the goats have been helping with to expedite the composting there because they just generate too much that their compost bins can't keep up with. So they reduced all the old pea vines, for example, recently very quickly into compost. And we walk the paths there, and they keep the paths clear from the so-called weeds. And the goat rental companies, a few of them tether goats, and I really want to just urge an abundance of caution. Tethering goats is dangerous to them. There are loose dogs. They can get themselves tangled and either injure a leg or get strangled or conceivably get loose, get into traffic, things like that. Tethering, the companies that tether brush-eating goats, it's penny-wise and pound-foolish. So there are a number of people around in the neighborhood and friends of ours who will invite us, plural, over for dinner. And we humans will barbecue or have a nice dinner, and the goats will eat their ivy-covered hillsides or this or that. It is amazing what they can eat in a couple of hours. And so we all come over for dinner and have a wonderful time. And everyone stays safe and healthy.
Now, I know that you love to drink fresh goat milk.
I do.
Do you also like to eat fresh goat cheese?
I do. I find that my time and attention is a little short when milk is at its peak. So the traditional breeding season is in the fall, which means baby goats are known as kids, in the spring. If you're really into gardening, having baby goats in the milking cycle, lactation cycle, any of you mothers out there who've had kids know this, that it peaks as the baby grows, and then it tapers off as demand wanes. So as the demand from the kids wane, then we milk more and we keep that lactation going depending upon their genetics and the consistency of our milking. So when the milk peaks, when you have spring babies and the milk peaks in spring and summer, as a gardener, I have no time or attention to make cheese right then. So I make a lot of yogurt. I make a lot of kefir. I do put a lot in the freezer to make soap later in the winter. I don't find it's good enough for cheese. I've become rather spoiled with the fresh quality. That's the most important thing I say all the time, is that money cannot buy the quality of milk that I have.
That's fantastic. Are you able to sell your milk and milk products, or are you not able to do that?
I am not. We are here in Washington State, and Washington State has a very, very, very strict dairy law. In other dairy laws vary tremendously from state to state. Here in Washington, they define selling milk to include giving, bartering, dispensing, sharing in any way, shape, or form. And you do have to be a licensed dairy to do that, even to have a goat share. You have to be licensed here, and that is...
So for the most part, probably people that are looking to have urban goats would be just using the milk themselves and not looking to start up a cottage industry.
Right. You can't do it as a cottage industry here in this state. In many other states, you can. Here, we are allowed to sell eggs off of our farm, but not milk at this time. And that, like I said, that varies from state to state.
Sure. What was it that first caused you to buy your very first goat?
Well, I was lucky in the sense that I did grow up on a farm, and we did have milk goat off and on, and goats were really the only thing that I missed from the farm. I couldn't wait to get away from the farm and move into the city. And then I had to deal with grocery store food instead of farm food. And I became vegetarian at that point. And went through some health challenges and what have you, and realized that most food in the grocery store is not the quality of food that I want. So when goats were legalized in Seattle, that was absolutely the first thing, highest priority for me to get. I know what's in my milk. I know what's not in my milk. I know the quality of sanitation that it was milked under. And that's just all very important to me.
Is there any kind of plant that goats shouldn't eat that because it'll make their milk taste funny?
I do notice a little bit that feeding them different things will change some of the qualities of the milk and the flavors of the milk, but it's minor and not objectionable and not that strong goaty taste for sure. And I don't find that it's the things that you would expect, like it's not garlic or something like that.
And it doesn't turn different colors depending on what colors of flowers I'm eating.
No, it doesn't. It all comes out white. And goats, that's another difference between goats and cows, is that goats metabolize all of the beta carotene that they take in. And so goat milk is pure, stark white, versus cow milk is kind of a creamy color because some of the beta carotene is still in cow's milk.
Well, the funny thing is that, I mean, there's a lot of noise around here, but it's not from the goats, it's not from the chickens. I mean, you hear cars and airplanes and everything else, and I can't even see that the noise would be that much of a factor.
The noise can be a factor, and you do want to think about the breed that you choose in the city very carefully, as well as goats are very smart, and if you have a strict pattern and a strict schedule and you don't follow that, they will talk to you about it. So I practice inconsistency. I practice managing expectations. And that helps a lot. And just like dog breeds, you know, different breeds, it's all about probability, right? So if you want a more active dog breed or a quieter dog breed, you go with certain breeds for probability. It doesn't say anything about individuals. There can be individual exceptions, of course. But I do have a breed called Mini La Manchas. They are very distinctive for their very teeny tiny ears. I always say that they have people ears. They have ears just like ours instead of big floppy pet ears. And they are known for being fairly quiet and personable, easy to live with. There are some breeds that are known for being quite vocal. And there it's not just the decibel level, but it's also the vocalization itself. So, for example, the normal you may have heard in the background, meh, meh, that's kind of their normal voice. That's one of the mamas calling her. She's in the pen. Her kid is out running around. She's calling her kid. Her kid is heading into being a preteen and is ignoring her, which is why she's calling to him. And so that meh, meh, that's kind of their normal trying to get your attention, something they want. They do that when we walk out the back door. We go to get food for them in the morning. That's what we're greeted with. If we're a little late to milk or they think we're taking a little too long for the food, they'll just up that a few decibels. Not objectionable at all. When they are coming into heat in the fall during breeding season, then that does get a little louder and a little more insistent. So instead of meh, it's meh.
Obviously, if you're going to have goats, you will have to learn goat speak. That was Laisha Bailey, urban goat herder and goat translator. We've included some pictures of Laisha's Goat Fest on the Garden Professors website, and that's gardenprofessors.com. Every week on the podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of our show. And I do get a lot of questions on how to use native plants in our home gardens. This is great. People are becoming more aware of native plants and how important they are in ecosystems and how we can use them actually in our gardens and landscapes. This is a way of preserving some of those species as development tends to encroach more and more on their natural habitat. But at the same time, when I'm out looking at plant death, which is one of my favorite things to do, oddly enough, I see more and more of these native gardens suffering from diseases, from pests, just from neglect or some other weird reason. We don't know why. A great example of one of these is salal, and that's a native shrub here in the Pacific Northwest that is used also in the floral industry. People will go out and cut the shiny, glossy green leaves and use them as kind of a backdrop for flowers. And it's got berries, so it's great for birds, and we just talked about why you should maybe plant for birds. It's attractive, it's not too big, it grows really well, so why is it dying all the time? Well, all you have to do is go out into the woods to see what its normal habitat is like. And its normal habitat is growing underneath great big Douglas fir trees. So it's pretty shady, it's cool, it's pretty moist. And then I see this salal planted in urban landscapes, oftentimes in the middle of highways as kind of part of a barrier between traffic lanes, sometimes in parking strips, sometimes in traffic circles. It's not exactly a Douglas fir forest. It's hot and it's dry. And it's a lot of problems for plants that aren't adapted to that. So this is why we see a lot of native plants that aren't acting like they're resistant to local pathogens and parasites. That's one of the benefits of using natives, is because they are adapted to those types of diseases. But it's kind of like if you're run down. If you're run down, you tend to be more susceptible to getting a cold or getting the flu. Same thing with these plants. If you put them someplace where they're going to get run down, maybe literally run down by traffic, they're not going to be very resistant to any type of stress that comes along. So we need to really think about where we're planting things and whether or not native plants are the best choices. So think about your garden. Maybe it's a great lush spot where the soil has been carefully worked and maintained, and you can grow just about anything there. But a lot of other spots, those same places I was talking about, the traffic circles, the parking strips, the median divides in the middle of highways, they have compacted soils that might be fill. It might not even really be soil. It might just be dirt. They're alkaline because there's been leaching of lime from concrete that's made them more alkaline than normal. They may get no fertilizer. They may get too much fertilizer. There might not be any mulch. There might not be any irrigation this summer. Lots of heat, air pollution, all kinds of conditions that are not natural. So you really have to select the urban plants very carefully. And if you want to use native plants, then you have to look at their very specific requirements. An example of a tree that's been used a lot along with the salals in our urban landscapes is madrone. And that's a tree actually used to be thought of as kind of a garbage tree by the timber industry because it grew so well as kind of a pioneer species in Douglas fir forests. Unfortunately, the conditions that it does well in, which tend to be fairly poor soils, not a lot of fertilizer, very well drained, it's really not the same thing as we have in our urban landscapes. So I see these poor trees struggling in nicely manicured lawns with lots of irrigation, lots of fertilizer, exactly the wrong conditions for madrones. So we see them suffer. A lot of them die from different types of cankers and other types of diseases. It's just it's not the best type of tree to use in our urban landscapes. Same thing has happened in the southwest United States. A lot of the native trees there, things like mesquite, have been used in parking lots. And while they are able to tolerate the heat very well, they can't tolerate the tiny little space they have for their roots. And what happens is that they won't be able to grow a decent root mass. When you have a storm come through, these things are blown over. So even in these areas where they do have plants that tolerate the conditions in terms of the temperature and the sun, if they don't have the right amount of root space, then you have to choose something else to take their place. So native may not be the way to go. And it's really okay not to be a purist when it comes to something like this. You need to choose the best plants for your home, garden, or landscape, but as long as they're not invasive plants. So if you're interested in finding out more science-based information for use in your own garden, I've got some really great resources to give to you. First of all, please visit my webpage, which is theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. Won't cost you a cent. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found the podcast entertaining and useful. I really welcome your comments and questions, and you can reach me at lyndacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be Selling Sustainability.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, and other stories and articles she's written, please visit theinformedgardener.com, thegardenersblog.com, or wsu.edu. Happy gardening!